This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. Earlier this week, Bloomberg Government hosted a defense summit. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's inaugural budget made quite the splash, so we gathered policymakers, members of Congress, and the defense industry to talk about it. Admiral James Winnifield Jr., Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sat down with Bloomberg Television's Peter Cook. Here's how it sounded.
What's the toughest call in this budget? Is it the compensation discussion? Is it another component? I know there are a lot of tough decisions in here, but from your perspective.
Well, it's hard to put your finger on what the hardest thing was that we discussed, because we had so many difficult issues. When you take this much money out of a budget, there are a lot of people who feel very strongly about the pieces that they're being asked to adjust. People in this business really believe in what they're doing, and they don't want to give up anything, because they sense how important it is. The compensation piece was, in fact, particularly difficult. We knew we needed to do it, but candidly, every one of the service chiefs, the chairman and myself, and the civilian leadership of the department care so deeply for these young men and women who have volunteered to serve our country, many of whom have given more than a limb to this country, that is the hardest thing for us to wrestle with. Knowing that it's something that we have, a trajectory that we have to adjust. That was probably the hardest part.
And sir, let me ask you the question that we're going to hear from some folks, budget hawks out there, who are going to suggest maybe you guys have not been aggressive enough here. For example, the retirement issue. Mm-hmm. We're putting that off till the commission reports back February 2015. That's quite some time away from now. How would you respond to those who say you haven't done enough on this front in this budget?
We need to give the retirement commission a chance to do its work. We felt very strongly that we had the information that we needed in order to make the required compensation decisions that we made, recommendations we made. But the retirement piece is so complex, so emotional, that we really wanted to let a separate body deliberate over this. We've given them information, and we really look forward to see what they come back with, but we did not want to rush into that. And candidly, as you look at the details, even if you adjust that program in many of the different ways we looked at, it's going to be hard to get money out of that and still meet the needs that we have for what a retirement program does.
Do you fully expect that you're going to find members of Congress say, Admiral, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to raise up those numbers for compensation. I'm not going to adjust the housing allowances. I'm going to make life better for the troops. When in reality, will he be making your life harder, the Pentagon's life harder?
This is a 20-dimensional Rubik's Cube when you're trying to put a budget together, and moving one part affects all other parts. So if somebody thinks they're doing us a favor by taking away the compensation savings, we've got to find something else to take out. It's going to come out of readiness or modernization or force structure in one way or another, assuming it's a zero-sum game unless they give us more money. So we believe we've struck the right balance here between the various moving pieces of this budget. We would love to see the budget enacted as is. We know that Congress will change it. We just hope that the changes will be minimal, because every piece does affect every other piece.
Is it different this time? Because once again, we have the sequester threat in 2016. This time, does that sales job by Secretary Hagel, is it that much more important? Because there isn't the ability to fudge these numbers going forward.
It's always a challenge because of completely understandable individual member concerns, where they have a particular program or a base or something that they're concerned about. And this is part of how Washington, D.C. works. Of course, it was harder this time because, the cuts continue. The first $487 billion wasn't easy. We managed it. This next set is all the much harder. And we did ask the services to plan at the full BCA cut level. That was the baseline. That's where we started from. And that was immensely difficult. Being able to potentially submit at a higher level than that took some of the pressure off and actually got us back into the band of risk that I described earlier.
And again, your message, when you sit down with a member of Congress and you talk about the $115 billion above, what would happen if we do have sequester kick in 2016, mm-hmm. the 420,000 U.S. Army troops, What's going to be your message to those members of Congress, again, about the risk? You're basically telling us here, and the Secretary did as well, that in terms of protecting national security to the level that you all feel comfortable, that budget number won't work.
Well, I mentioned we are sort of barely inside the acceptable band of risk for the current strategy under the budget submission. When you start to look at the kinds of things that would come out if we had to go back to the BCA, we would lose probably 50 to 60,000 Army forces when you combine the active and reserve component. 7,000 Marines. We would take an aircraft carrier out in midlife. We would lose six more surface combatants. We would lose the entire KC-10 fleet. We would lose probably 10 full Reaper or Predator orbits. That's about 30 airplanes. We would lose construction of a submarine, which is terribly important to us in some of the areas around the world where we operate. It will cut into our research and development, which the industry people here know very well is the lifeblood of any industry that's trying to come out of a financial crisis. You've got to keep your seed corn going, and it'll hurt our all of those things add up to really pretty quickly having us exit the band of acceptable risk for the strategy that we currently have. We'd have to change the strategy.
Has there been a concerted effort this time around? When sequester was first looming, we heard warnings from Secretary Panetta about what would happen, the talk of a hollow military. This time there's specifics attached to what those consequences would be. Do you think, was there obviously a conscientious effort to do that this time around and to explain to members of Congress what those consequences would be?
I'll tell you.
Because there is a conventional wisdom among some on Capitol Hill that sequester was a good thing.
Yeah.
That the savings have done good things for the U.S. economy, for the budget picture.
Yeah. On the one hand, you know, never waste a crisis, right? When you're under financial pressure, it causes you to really take a close look at your business. We are becoming more efficient. We are challenging all the assumptions about what it is we do as a military. But that said, the sequester level with the cuts that we would take would cause us to have to act differently in the world. I would also make the point that showing these two different budget levels, the BCA level and the president's budget level, I wish we were clever enough to call that a tactic. It's not. We really believed that we needed to, taking into account that the BCA caps are currently the law of the land, we felt responsibly we had to determine what we would do at that level. But we also felt we needed to determine what we would do at a level that would allow us to continue to execute the defense strategy. Now, if somebody wants to view that as a tactic, that's fine. That's not why we did it. We felt we really needed to show both levels.
Let me ask you about a couple of specifics within the budget, a couple of platforms, because I know a lot of folks here have interest in some of them and want to know why some of these decisions were made. The Littoral Combat Ship. Mm-hmm. I did not hear from Secretary Hagel a ringing endorsement of the LCS. The decision to limit the purchase to 32, what's the future for the LCS?
Well, first of all, I think that we're doing a smart thing here. We're asking the Navy to go back, look at the program, and tell us whether we really think that it's going to meet their needs as we go forward in the future. And I think that's going to be a very healthy process where they will come back with an answer. It could be a new ship, it could be a different ship, or it could be an upgunned LCS. I think there's a lot of potential in there for that to occur. I know industry will work very hard to help us answer that question. And we've got the right people in place in the Navy to do it. Sean Stackley is a fantastic acquisition executive, and will do that job very well. So I think it's a good call. I think we're going to be okay in the future. But I think it was a smart move that Secretary Hagel did in asking this question.
Within the Navy, what are your biggest questions about the LCS right now? Is it a question of survivability? Is it a question of, is it potent enough as a threat?
Yeah, of course, I haven't been in the Navy in a long time.
Sure.
So I'm a joint guy right now. So the better, more detailed answer would come from my Navy compadres. But one of the things I mentioned to somebody the other day is I view the LCS as kind of going through its V-22 phase. Remember back when the V-22 was going through testing challenges and people were, it had a couple of crashes and it was going through some really rocky times. People kind of forgot about that. Today, why can't I have more V-22s? There's a demand signal out there in the real world today, and I wish I could tell you all about it, for more V-22s. Wish we had some more out there protecting our diplomatic facilities, and the airplane's performing extremely well. So I think the Littoral Combat Ship is kind of going through that phase. But I also think it would be very smart for us to take a look at what else can we do, either with that those two ships or with a different concept, to make sure that we're covered for the future.
And describe to us this idea of a new frigate.
Well, you want to be able to send a ship into harm's way that has a good chance of surviving, that can execute the kinds of things that aren't at quite the level that a cruiser or a larger destroyer would do, but still get the presence job done, that gets the anti-submarine warfare, counter-mine warfare, and counter-surface warfare, but also other jobs. I think that there's potential for this ship, whatever it ends up being, whether it's another LCS or whether it's another ship, to be able to do more strike, longer range strike, to be able to do more special operations work, and potentially even be a good platform for the Marines. So I think there's a lot of promise here. I'm actually enthusiastic about what we're going to see come back, regardless of which answer the Navy chooses to go for.
What about the F-35? Give us your assessment of the F-35 and its future right now.
I think it's got a bright future. It's a good airplane. It will get on track. We're working the software very hard. We're working the testing program very hard. But it is a very complex animal. But I can't wait to see this thing out there in the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps as it does its job, because it's a pretty special airplane.
Are we going to need 2,400 F-35s?
Well, the question is going to be whether we can afford them, I think, as much as whether we need them. I don't have the exact numbers at the tip of my tongue for how many, the exact numbers that we need. As always, those numbers fluctuate wildly with budgets, with other pressures that are on the budget. But it's an airplane with a solid future. We're committed to it, and I can't wait to see it out there.
There's a debate in this budget again, and you mentioned it, if sequester kicks in between 11 carriers versus 10. What's your message to Americans out there who wonder, in this day and age, do we need aircraft carriers? How important is this? I'm going to pay a visit next week by chance, a reporting story on to the Gerald Ford under construction. What's your answer to that? Do we need aircraft carriers today? Do we need 11 of them?
Yeah, you know, it's an old adage. When there's a crisis, people ask, you know, where's the aircraft carrier? And I can't tell you how many times that's happened just in the 2.5 years I've been in this job. So for all people,
couldn't that be part of the old thinking that you said we should be reassessing?
Well, we are. We are going to reassess it. We always reassess those things. We're putting new platforms on those carriers, longer range platforms, more capable platforms. One of the principles we've found over the years is that there are select areas where you can take an old platform and put new things on it, and you actually end up in pretty good shape rather than having to buy a whole brand new platform. But there are other times when you need to either incrementally, you know, make that type of platform better, as we're doing with the Gerald Ford, as I think you'll see next week, or just start from scratch and build an entirely new platform like an F-35. The carrier is important to us. In the last 2.5 years, again, it constantly asked. During the Syria crisis we had over the last fall, where's the aircraft carrier? Whenever the Iran crisis has come to a crescendo, where are the aircraft carriers? Why can't we have more? How long is it going to take to get 5 or 6 there? The key advantage that you have from that platform is its independence from any dependence on basing ashore. And politically, diplomatically, and militarily, that makes a huge difference.
Let me ask you about, again, selling some of this to Congress. You mentioned the BRAC process and having to explain to people that BRAC has been successful. Mm-hmm. That's an uphill fight, isn't it?
Sure. Of course it's an uphill fight. Nobody wants to see a base go away. I'll tell you, one of the adages is nobody necessarily cares if the F-15 squadron at that base is flying or not. Readiness has no constituency. They just want it to be there, okay? And the same thing is true with bases. What we need to do a better job of explaining, I think, is countering the narrative of the 2005 BRAC, which really had two pieces. One, the largest part of that BRAC was what we call the transformational BRAC, where we were literally combining Air Force and Navy bases, moving things around. There were a lot of changes that cost us a lot of money, and it's taken a long time to start realizing the savings from that component of that BRAC. The other part of that BRAC was a closure BRAC. We saw the savings pretty quickly out of that. Cost $6 billion to implement relatively in the first few years, and we're getting $3 billion a year out of that closure BRAC. That's the kind of money we need, and we are not necessarily interested in another transformational BRAC. We're interested in a modest closure BRAC so we can start to capture the savings. We've got about 25% excess infrastructure. I don't know of any industry person in this room today who feels they could survive carrying 25% excess infrastructure. They'd get rid of it immediately.
Election year, it's going to be tough.
I know. We're only asking for it in 2017. So,
okay, noted.
That's a good year.
Not an election year. Remember that. Let me ask you from the industry perspective. What is your message to defense contractors right now, in light of this budget, going forward, in terms of what you all expect? What needs to happen differently from the industry? If they need to retool and reassess, and a lot of them have been doing it for the last couple of years getting ready for this moment, are they ready for these changes? Do you think there more needs to be done from the industry? What's your message?
I give industry a lot of credit. They spend a lot of time and invest a lot of resources in trying to look into the future and prepare for it. The smart industries do. Those are the ones who do the best. I think that a couple of things, and I would, Frank Kendall's really the right guy to ask this question, but I would say first, keep the innovations coming. We're gonna protect R&D money as best we can. We've always tried to do that. Frank Kendall's done a very good job of fighting for that inside our budget process, and we responded to that. It's going to come down a little bit, but disproportionately less compared to some of the other areas of the budget. So keep the good ideas coming, and keep knocking on our door to show us what you can do. The other thing is...
Is the engine part of that? Sorry to interrupt, but...
The engine is part of that. It does two things for us. One, it's the potential for giving us a more powerful engine that saves a lot of fuel. And second of all, it keeps a very important part of the industrial base alive. The other piece for industry is continue the good work you've been doing and push even harder, as we are, on becoming more efficient and getting your costs down. That is going to be terribly important over the coming years. It may mean, I don't know, smaller profit margins. I'm not sure about that. That depends on the industry. But the more industry can do to control costs and get us best value for taxpayer money on the systems that we need, that will be an advantage.
Cybersecurity. Yep. Growth area for business?
I think it is.
A bigger worry on the part of you and the rest of the Joint Chiefs and everyone at the Pentagon?
Yeah, you know, we say that flat is the new growth in DOD, and you know, Special Operations Forces are sort of flat right now, which is the new growth. Cyber is about the only area where we're actually, no kidding, growing in terms of people and capacity. So Keith Alexander, and if he is confirmed, his successor, Mike Rogers, are you know, empowered individuals right now on the part of defending our own networks, on the part of potential cyber operations out there in the netherworld, and also helping defend our own, helping the civilian part of our government, the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and the like, do their job of protecting the nation's networks. It's a growth industry. I think there's plenty of room for industry in there. Yeah.
Where is it in terms of your risk factors right now? Out there,
it's pretty high. It's pretty high. It's the problem with cyber is the speed at which an attack develops, and whether you are able to discern that attack before it occurs, and if you have a tool in place that can block it or counter it as it occurs, that's a huge challenge for us right now. It's a little bit like missile defense, except it happens a lot faster. Can you take it out on the pad? Do you have to take it out in midair? Or do you have to clean up on aisle 9 when it hits? And we're really, you know, Keith's working very hard on that. Serious challenges in there, but we got the best people in the world working on it.
You talked a little bit about innovation. And, of course, innovation can be on the industry side, new technology. But you also talked about innovation within the military itself, how we fight wars, what the wars of the future will look like. What, to you, are the biggest lessons learned right now, for example, from Afghanistan? What are the wars of the future? And I know that Secretary Gates has said we're pretty bad at predicting what those will be, but that's part of what you guys have to do.
Yeah. Well, we've learned an awful lot from these last two campaigns that we've been in. The first thing is leveraging our expertise in networks to do networked warfare. It's just unbelievable how far we've come in the last 10 years in networking our command and control and networking our warriors together, and there's more we can do in that area. The other thing, and very much related to that, is the integration of intelligence and operations. When I first started out in this business, and for my first 20 years in this business, you never saw intelligence people and operators sitting in the same room. And the Special Operations Committee showed us the way, jammed them all together, showed that you can take the intelligence you learn on one night's operations and spin it around very quickly the next day and leverage it into the next night operations, and you can unravel a threat network fairly quickly when you do that. They just can't keep up with you. Well, we're applying that in all aspects of what we do now. It's not a natural act sometimes for people, but it really works when we do it, and that's a sort of a hidden lesson. There are a host of other lessons that we have learned, not just from these last campaigns, but intelligence, linking intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance tightly into what we do, cyber and the like. There's a whole host of opportunities out there.
And is that going to allow you to do more with less? Is that why we can reduce force structure, because we've enhanced that communications, that sort of thing?
I would say that the innovations of the last few years and the innovations we have in play right now will allow us in some areas to achieve our ends with fewer means. That's what I talked about in my discussion about Waze. And we really want to empower our people as best we can. We want to get the brightest young people that we can attacking all these problems. They always do well. When you present them with a challenge, they always rise to it. And it may well be that we can do even better than we thought, frankly, with some of the decreases in this force structure that we're going to see. We're cautious about that right now. We don't want to bank on it too much, but it's very definitely an imperative for us.
How worried are you about recruiting the talent you need for the military of the future? You're sending a message right now with this budget, mm-hmm. whether you care to or not. Mm-hmm. Things are getting smaller. There may be fewer opportunities out there. We're not going to be in Afghanistan to the extent we've mm-hmm. been in Afghanistan. What are your worries about attracting the talent you need to serve the military going forward?
I think, you know, ironically, the biggest concern that we have when we talk about recruiting people is the health of the economy. As our economy comes back, there are going to be more opportunities out there for young people to not go in the military, to get a job that is a good job, that gives them health care and does the whole thing as they make their choices as young men and women, either right out of high school or coming out of college. So that's the thing that we actually worry about the most, although we all hope for it, right? We hope that the economy comes back. When we look at the types of decisions that we've made in this budget about pay and compensation, those are traditionally not the factors that determine whether we're going to have a young man or woman come into the military as we do the entrance surveys to these folks. They're interested in serving their country. They're interested in starting a new life. They're looking for adventure. It's really quite striking to see what the factors are that cause young men and women to come in the military. The real challenge, I think, is going to be making sure we can retain the quality people that we have. And we're engineering that very carefully. It was a factor as we looked at the various compensation proposals that we made, trying to balance those out.
All right, final question for you, because I'm at 0-0 here. Your message to the mothers and fathers of the men and women who are out there serving right now, mm-hmm. can you assure them that this budget will adequately prepare, train, and equip their sons and daughters for the fights of the future?
If we're allowed to do the kinds of things that we need to do with this budget, some of the reforms, the efficiencies, and the like, if we're allowed to shape this force structure the way we think it needs to be shaped, which means bringing it down a little bit, then we will have the resources that we need in order to make sure that it's modern and ready, the force structure that we have. So yes, I think we can, but we're going to need a lot of help from the Congress in order to get that across the finish line.
Admiral James Winnifield Jr., Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, being interviewed by Bloomberg Television's Peter Cook. And with that, we close out Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to everyone who helped make this show possible. And thank you very much to my friends at Federal News Radio 1500 AM. For Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, my name is Alan Scott. Thank you for listening.